Okay. I was going to say, okay, everyone. I don't know if that is quite accurate. There is not everyone here. It's a very empty room. Very unusual on a Friday night to see about four, I can see five people, six people, including my, including myself. No, seven people, including myself and the Venerable over here. And one is about to leave, is that right? Okay, no, that's very good. So this isn't fascinating. This is, of course, the consequences of the coronavirus, what is it, epidemic, or whatever you call it. So this is how things go. And I'm not going to talk an enormous amount about the coronavirus tonight, because I guess we talk about that so much already. Sometimes we get fed up with the coronavirus. I think it's impossible not to touch on it, because it is such a prominent thing in our minds. It's something that really needs to be dealt with in a skillful way. And for that reason, you obviously have to deal with it in one way or another. I'm going to talk about more of a broad vision of things, but just very briefly, the idea of how to deal with the coronavirus, of course, is just to, one of the great things about these problems in the world is that they remind you of the limits of the worldly life. They remind you of the limits of samsaric existence, the five sense realm, and all the things that we have in that world. And whenever we are reminded of that, if we are wise, we turn towards the spiritual life instead. That is kind of the benefit, one of the great benefits of seeing the problems, the suffering, the impermanence, the unreliability of that world, is actually letting go of it and focusing on the spiritual path instead. So remember that. It's not just a cloud has a silver lining. It's actually the other way around. This is the whole cloud is of silver, and the lining is just the slight darkness on the sides. If you use these things skillfully, you benefit far more than you actually lose from the problems that the world provides for you. So keep that in mind. And of course, it's not just that, but it is also a great opportunity to practice the spiritual teachings. If you do that, coronavirus, of course, you know, these problems in the world, it gives a chance to have more compassion and care for each other, to understand the suffering that we all have as a consequence of these problems. It is one of the strange coincidences is that the coronavirus, right, getting him as a corona, is very similar to the Pali word karuna. Yeah, karuna means compassion. Corona means, I don't know what it means, some kind of virus type. So instead of calling it the coronavirus, call it the karuna virus. The compassion virus. Why? Because it is the natural consequence of the suffering in the world that compassion arises if you focus on it in a skillful way. And that is kind of the purpose of this. So instead of coronavirus, let's try to make the karuna virus be even more contagious than the coronavirus. Then we are in business. Then we're kind of heading in the right direction as a consequence. So that is kind of the spiritual aspect of the coronavirus, how to deal with it in a very fairly straightforward fashion. But instead of talking too much about that, what I want to look at is also the broader picture, because the reality is that we are, as people, we are still attached to the world to some extent, and we can try to turn our attention from the worldly things towards the spiritual things, but there's often a limit to how far we're actually able to turn our attention away from the world. The attachments will often still bring us back to the world. So the question how should we actually think about the world? Is it advisable to think of the world as just going down the drain and being problematic and being all about suffering? Or is it advisable to kind of take a step back and ask ourselves if there is a broader picture here to be understood, even about the world itself? Not just the fact that we should move towards spirituality, but maybe the world itself is not quite as hopeless as sometimes it seems. There is a balance here, because if you become too despairing about the world, especially if you haven't walked a spiritual path so far yet, it means that it can become very problematic for you and very difficult to deal with the problems around us. And I think if you reflect upon the world in the right way. Actually, it doesn't. It's not necessarily as bad as it may seem. Often there are hidden things happening under the surface that may be driving the world in the right way. What we see is often the surface things, and of course the surface things at any one time may be very bad, they may be neutral, they may be good. But the whole picture also includes the kind of the undercurrents that happen to society, leading it in different directions. And one of the interesting things that I have noticed is that if you look at that broader pictures, it looks to me as if there are currents in our society that may be, it's very hard to say for sure, but may be driving us towards a more spiritual kind of life in our society, in a very general sense, yeah, towards more thinking about the mind, how to develop the mind, how to live better lives, yeah, and how to think about the world in an entirely new way. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about, and then see what kind of comes out of that this way of looking at things. And I want to start off by just a little historical overview. And this is not my specialty, so I may kind of make mistakes in these kind of things, but it's nevertheless, I think it's interesting and worthwhile just thinking a little bit about history and see where human society has gone over long stretches of time, and from that to understand where we're heading in the future. You need to see the broader aspect of things to understand the general trends of what is happening in our society. And this is going to be mostly about kind of European culture, if you like, because that's what I'm familiar with. I'm going to have to leave out other parts of human culture, otherwise it's going to make it too difficult for me to really make any sense of this. And one of the starting points, I think, is for me today, is the Middle Ages in Europe, because the Middle Ages had a very powerful influence on European culture and later trends. And to be able to understand kind of where society is now, I think it's a good starting point. And the Middle Ages in Europe are very often portrayed as being very dark and very difficult times, times when there was a lot of oppression. The religion at the time, Catholicism, was very powerful at that time in Europe. And the Catholic Church basically was a very oppressive element in the Middle Ages. We have read about history books, we hear about all the Inquisition, you hear about the witch hunts, and you hear about the very kind of harsh reality if you disagree with the Catholic Church, or you weren't following the dogma of the Catholic Church, you could be excommunicated and all kind of terrible things could happen to you at that particular time. So this is, and it was very monolithic in large parts of Europe, not everywhere perhaps, but my understanding is that the Catholic Church was really in charge, and it was the only game in town, as they say. There was no other possibilities of religious practice. Yeah, you couldn't really be a Buddhist in the Middle Ages. There was no such thing. Maybe if you lived on the borders of Europe, you could be a Muslim, or maybe you could be a Orthodox Greek, perhaps, even in those days. But that would have been on the sides of Europe. But Catholicism was really the game at that particular time. It was very dark and very difficult. But what is interesting, even about this particular time in Europe, is that there was a mystical tradition. It wasn't all about dogma. It wasn't all about the church being in charge of everything. Because the Catholic Church was divided into the priesthood and all the churches on the one hand, which was kind of the standard way that people would relate to the church in that society, but you also had monasticism on the other hand. And what is interesting about the monasticism of the Middle Ages, there actually were quite a few mystics in Europe at that particular time. And I did check this out once on the Wikipedia page, and according to this Wikipedia page, it was several hundreds, in fact, of these mystics around Europe. And what is fascinating, if you start to read some of the accounts of these mystics, what you see is that you start to see that the way they practiced is actually very similar to the way that Buddhist monastics or Buddhist mystics are practiced throughout the ages and even practice in the present day. Some very famous mystics, there was one, I only know a very few of these, but one who is quite well known is a Spanish nun called Teresa of Avila. And she explains her mystical experiences as the rooms in a castle, apparently, going into deeper and deeper rooms. And the way she describes it, it seems to be very similar to the experience of samadhi that you have in other mystical traditions, including Buddhism. The idea of going within, of letting the world go outside, and then reaching these ecstatic and very special states as a consequence of that. So the society at that time had this division, between, you can call it dogma of the church on the one hand, and then the renunciant life, or the spiritual life that was practiced by monastics on the other hand. But the problem was that the monastic tradition of the Catholic Church was hidden away. It was hidden away in monasteries with monks and nuns. It was very hard for ordinary lay Catholics to really see that spiritual tradition. So all they saw was really the dogmatic tradition of Catholicism. Because in Catholicism, you have this very strong divide between the church, or the kind of the external element with the priests and the churches, and then the cloistered existence of the monastics on the other hand. It was a very deep segregation. But when you look at history, one of those aspects was very inspirational. The spiritual aspect was very inspiring, people attaining some very profound states, whereas the church aspect was very depressing and very oppressive. And yet what we learn about history is the oppressive aspect, and we forget very often about the spiritual aspect of the Catholic Church. And I think that as Buddhists, this is an important point for us to keep in mind. The idea that what really is inspiring for people is not the dogma of Buddhism, or the dogmas, or the way, the views that we hold as Buddhist monastics or Buddhist lay people. That is not the inspiring thing at all. Often that can be also be very bad. It can lead to all kinds of problems. As some of the problems we have seen around the Buddhist world in various places often come from these dogmas. What is inspiring in Buddhism really is the spiritual aspect, the practice, the kindness, and all of these kind of things. And also, of course, the meditation practice itself. That is what is inspiring. And when we look at Buddhist, at the history of the world, you can see what actually draws people in, what actually is fascinating, and what is only really oppressive at the end of the day. And this is really what happened in the Middle Ages. So let us learn from that rather than making similar kind of mistakes. And you do see people in the Buddhist world making these kind of mistakes in the present day. So let's not go down that avenue. Let's remember what the Buddha taught. And the Buddha's path was always a spiritual path, a path of meditation, a path of kindness, a path of developing your heart and developing your mind, not of arguing about abstruse doctrines and these kind of things. But anyway, what was interesting in history following on from what happened with the Catholic Church was, of course, it got so oppressive with the Catholic Church that eventually there was a rebellion in European society. And the rebellion against the Catholic Church, it took many forms. One of it was, of course, the Reformation, when you had the Protestant churches arising in Europe with Martin Luther and the and also the Church of England getting established and all of these kind of things. That was one aspect of it. Then you have the Counter-Reformation, with the Catholic Church also reforming to some extent. And all of these things were in a response to the problems of Europe, the problems of the Catholic, the existing Church. So you saw all these currents of history starting to change as a consequence of that. Another very important consequence, probably, I think, in part of the church and the dominance of the church in Europe, was, of course, the Enlightenment. The Renaissance and the Enlightenment centuries happening after, after starting really with Galileo, or perhaps even slightly earlier. And that was a very new way of thinking about the world that also, in large part, was a reaction to what happened beforehand. Bringing back the ancient ideas from Greece, the idea that there is insight to be had into the world, understanding the world, and not just kind of blindly worshipping a god as if that is everything there is. And that gradually, as then science was brought back into European society, of course, it had a very large impact on religion in Europe. The space for religion started to kind of narrow down. Yeah, the idea of God being the creator of the universe, God's role in the universe started to become less and less and less. Yeah, you have the idea of the God of the gaps, the idea that there is a, you know, whatever, wherever the gap is, that's where God is. So whatever science couldn't explain, that's where God kind of comes in. And as science advanced, the gaps in knowledge became smaller and smaller and smaller. And the role of God also became smaller and smaller and smaller. And God kind of receded into the background from being someone who interfered in human things and human society. He became more like something, or he or it or whatever it is, became more something really far away, something distant, more like some kind of world spirit or something like that. And of course, after a while, after God kind of receding into the background, people started to wonder, well, why do we even believe in this God? If God is changing all the time, if the nature of God is not what the church said it was in the beginning, and they are changing this nature over time, why do we even believe in this idea of a God? And of course, that is why how science eventually ended up rejecting the idea of a creator God entirely and throwing it out. And as science threw out the idea of a creator God, it also threw out the idea of a soul. And the end result of this process, and this is very problematic from a Buddhist point of view, the end result of this process is that everything was explainable according to material phenomena. Yeah, this is called the doctrine of physicalism, the idea that everything comes from physical things, and the whole world can be explained on that basis. And according to that doctrine, because everything can be explained from physical phenomena, it means the mind is a mere adjunct. It's what is called an epiphenomenon of the world. The mind arises out of material phenomena, and it doesn't really have much impact in the world apart from being something that arises out of material phenomena. And this, from a Buddhist point of view, is very, very problematic. And I will come back to this later on. Because if the mind just arises out of material phenomena, then many of the core teachings of Buddhism don't make any sense anymore. Ideas such as rebirth, the idea that there is something called karma, which goes from one life to the next one, and you have to reap the consequences in the future, and all of these kind of things. The idea that the enlightenment experience actually is the ending of rebirth, and all of that falls by the wayside. It becomes impossible if the mind is a mere epiphenomenon of the material phenomena of the world. So it is very problematic. But what is interesting, and this is what I really want to talk about, what is interesting is that if you look at the world of science and philosophy in the present day, it's actually starting to challenge this particular view. This view has been in the ascendancy for a long time, and it has become like the cultural mainstream in Western society and probably around the world, actually. But over the last few years, there has been a challenge both from philosophy and also from science about this particular view. And that is very interesting. So this is one kind of challenge this view has had. Another challenge that this view has had is more from people who are searching for meaning. People realize that if you have a purely materialistic outlook on society or the world in general, it means that there is very little meaning left. Meaning is actually, everything becomes very meaningless and pointless from that particular point of view. And these two challenges have been very important. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about the philosophical and scientific challenge to that materialistic or physicalist view of looking at the world. Let's start with the idea of, first of all, how this scientific paradigm, how it is supposed to work. So the idea here is that the idea is that the mind arises out of material phenomena. The problem with that, and this is a philosophical problem, is that it is impossible to explain how your personal experience can actually arise out of material phenomena. Why is that? Because material phenomena are measurable things in the outer world, and those measurable things are things like mass. If you have an electron or a proton or whatever, it has a certain mass. It has a charge, yeah? It has a spin, and I don't know what else it has, but these are kind of some of the main ideas of the physical world. Whereas the inner world of experience, what is that? Well, the inner world of experience is the feelings, yeah, the feeling of pain, or the seeing of colors, the seeing a color of yellow or red or whatever. When you taste something, you taste, you know, whether it is like a carrot or a potato, it has a different kind of taste, yeah? This is the inner world of experience. And the problem is that from a modern philosophical point of view, the movement from a physicalist world where everything is physical, you cannot move from that and then actually explain inner experience from that physical reality. There's what is called an explanatory gap there, which is almost impossible to bridge. Actually, it is impossible, according to many philosophers. Yeah, there is no bridging between those two things because we are talking about two fundamentally different entities, and there's no way that one can be explained in terms of the other one. So there's a massive philosophical problem, yeah? And it is quite interesting because one of the ways that the modern outlook tries to explain this, one of the ways is this idea that when things get very complex, for example, you have a brain, yeah, this kind of gooey thing inside of our heads. There's a brain. I think there's a brain in here somewhere. Or I hope so. Otherwise, I'm in trouble. But this gooey brain inside of our heads, yeah, is a very complex kind of organ with all kind of twists and turns and all kind of things. And the idea is that when something is really complicated, and you have all these neurons kind of firing in there and all kind of in all kind of patterns and whatever, then somehow consciousness, bang, comes out because of the complexity of these things. Yeah. So somehow, when matter gets very complex, consciousness comes out of it. But as many people have pointed out, there is no principle that can possibly explain how mere complexity can give rise to consciousness. Yeah, it doesn't really explain anything here. There's still like a sense of magic there, of going from the complex material phenomena to an actually conscious experience in the first person experience. So there is that explanatory gap still remains. Just because you make things complex, doesn't actually explain what is really going on. And if we think about modern ideas of artificial intelligence, so very often you hear these days, you hear people speculating, what if you make a very powerful machine with very complicated electronic circuits or whatever, if it gets complex enough, the idea is then consciousness will somehow emerge in this robot or this artificial intelligence machine. Yeah, bang, suddenly the robot will see red. Wow, I can see red, thanks a lot. Kind of like might happen to a robot. Yeah, that's kind of the idea. And the robot then becomes conscious because of the complexity of the underlying mechanisms or the physical mechanisms in there. But from a Buddhist point of view, this doesn't make any sense. Yeah, because from a Buddhist point of view, consciousness does not arise from physical phenomena in that way at all. From a Buddhist point of view, consciousness arises from previous instances of consciousness. If you have a thing like dependent origination, one of the most beautiful and profound teachings of the Buddha, what the Buddha says, consciousness arises from willed activities. Sankara paccaya vijnana. Yeah, sankara paccaya means that consciousness comes from the willed activities. And willed activities, well, a will can only exist with consciousness. Yeah, so previous consciousness, including the will, is required, according to the dependent origination, to then give rise to subsequent consciousnesses. So in Buddhism, the idea that you get a very complex thing, and suddenly consciousness pops out because it's very complicated, doesn't really make any sense. Is it possible, from a Buddhist point of view, that the machine might become conscious? And I've said this here before, I think, and there may be a certain way that is possible, and the only way that I can think of is that if someone wants to get reborn as a machine. Yeah, so if you really want to get reborn as a machine, maybe you will. Yeah, because then consciousness might attach to that machine. So what is that old saying again? Be careful what you wish for, because it might just happen. So be careful not to want to get reborn as a machine. Yeah, it might sound really cool to be a machine, but I'm not sure if it is all that cool when it comes down to it. It might actually be a lot of suffering to be a machine. People might just turn you off. Yeah. Not very nice, I'm going to turn you off. No, don't turn me off, please. I don't know, something like that might happen here. So don't be reborn as a machine. But that is the only way I can see consciousness arising, yeah, in a machine. Someone actually having the silly desire to get reborn as a machine. So please don't have that desire, because again, it might just happen. That might be disastrous. Imagine having a machine come up for a counseling or something. Oh, I have so much suffering. Yeah, whoa, dukkha, machine dukkha. And then that would be, I think Ajahn Brahm says, there's enough human beings as there is, we don't need machines as well to ask for counseling here. I think I asked him about this once, that's what he said. Please keep the machines unconscious. Something like that. Anyway, it's not going to happen, so it's not really a problem. So what we are seeing here is that from a Buddhist point of view, the idea of intelligence or consciousness arising in machines, it's not going to happen. It's basically impossible, because consciousness gives rise to consciousness. It has to come from previous instances of consciousness. And of course, what is my point here is that this is also gradually how certain philosophers, certain very important philosophers of the world, are gradually coming to the same conclusion. It is called the hard problem of consciousness, because it is impossible to explain, even in principle, how consciousness can arise from material phenomena. So that is the philosophical side of things. What about the scientific side of things? Here too, it is quite fascinating. I'm not going to talk about all the kind of unusual kind of scientific research happening around the world. There's a lot of very interesting, unusual science happening around the world, like near-death experience and these kind of things. But I'm not going to talk about that. Rather, I'm going to talk more about what is called the hard sciences. In other words, those that are really established in our mainstream, and to see whether they too actually might be heading in that kind of direction. Of course, one of the things that we sometimes invoke in spiritual circles is the idea of quantum mechanics. Well, I'm not going to say much about quantum mechanics, because I don't really know anything about quantum mechanics. But one of the things that we do know, which has been talked about very often, is that one of the main ideas of quantum mechanics is that you need consciousness for things to happen. Without consciousness, without the observer observing something, there can be no event. Nothing can actually materialize. So from a quantum mechanical perspective, as far as I understand, and I have what people say, the world can only actually exist if there is a conscious observer. I'm not going to talk about it, because I don't pretend to understand this. But what was very fascinating was that back in, I think it was 2005, there was an article by a very well-known physicist called Richard Conhenry, and you can look him up if you like. And he wrote a lead article in Nature magazine. Nature magazine is the preeminent scientific journal in the world, probably. And this was a lead article in Nature magazine, the preeminent scientific journal of the world. And what does he say in this article? And what he says the universe is mental. And then he has this article, this is in Nature magazine of all places, where he says that the outcome of quantum mechanics requires that we regard the world as mental. That is kind of astonishing, isn't it? This is the preeminent journal in the world. It is physics, one of the hard sciences, not some kind of science that is kind of on the edge of society. And that is where the physicists of the world are heading. And these experiments that lead to these kind of conclusions have just been confirming the idea, actually taking it even further since that time in 2005. So this is the physics, where that is kind of gradually perhaps heading. It's hard to know exactly, but there is some evidence going in that way. Then there is neuroscience. Neuroscientists who are trying to explain the correlation between the brain patterns and conscious activity. And of course, what they have been finding is that there is a lot of correlation between consciousness and neural activity. But they too realize that there is a massive explanatory gap. Just because you have neural activity doesn't really explain how there can be consciousness. And some of these neuroscientists, again, these are some of the most famous neuroscientists in the world. One of them is called Christoph Koch. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, but something like that. And he has moved away from the physicalist idea of the universe and moved towards an idea of the universe that also takes into account the mind. Yeah, why? Because he argues it's impossible to really account for the mind without bringing it in at the very base. One of the fundamental aspects of existence must be mind. So this is philosophy, yeah, and this is science kind of shifting. And these, many of the things that I've been mentioning now would have been unthinkable only about 15, 20 years ago. Many of these things would not have been spoken by people in these kind of positions. There is a shift, there is a movement in the way people think about these things, which is very fascinating and very interesting. So what exactly are they talking about? What are the kind of ideas that they are coming up with? And there are certain philosophical doctrines that are being kind of presented, and I thought I would just talk about them very briefly and see how they compare to Buddhist ideas of the world. One of the kind of classical views of mind is what is called the dualist idea of the world, where on the one hand you have material things, on the other hand you have the mind. This is what Descartes very famously talked about, this kind of dualist idea of the soul on the one hand, and material phenomena on the other one. And this idea of dualism has been very thoroughly debunked in philosophy, because the problem with that kind of idea is, well, how do you combine two completely different types, two different kinds of substances? How can they work together, as they obviously do in a human being, if they are completely separate? So basically, it is regarded as not really an acceptable way of thinking about these things. What about Buddhism? Is Buddhism a dualism? And the answer is that Buddhism is not really dualistic in that particular sense. And the reason is because in Buddhism we have this idea of many different degrees of material phenomena. Yeah, on the one hand you have a physical body, which is very like the hard physical body we have now. But from a Buddhist point of view, the physical body can also become more refined. Yeah, in Buddhism you have like out-of-body experiences, for example, where you have a refined body. So in Buddhism, it is not dualistic in quite the way that it is with Descartes. It's more a gradual change where material phenomena can have actually many degrees to them. You can move through different kind of fine material bodies until eventually maybe the body can cease completely, but that is way at a very, very high level or depth of meditation before that actually happens. So this is kind of fascinating. Buddhism has kind of a slightly different view between the connection between mind and body, whereby the body itself, or the physical phenomena themselves, are influenced by the mind, and depending on how refined the mind is, physical phenomena also are refined as the mind is refined. So it's a different outlook, and maybe we should kind of put that forward to some of these philosophers. Yeah, this is the Buddhist outlook. Maybe you want to take that into account and see if that makes any sense for you. This is one way of thinking about the world. Another way is what is called the panpsychism. Becoming quite popular now in philosophical circles. It is becoming popular in part because it was put forward also by Bertrand Russell, apparently, back in the 1920s, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. And the idea of panpsychism is that consciousness is there at the very base of existence. So that every material object also has a degree of consciousness associated with it. So how does that fit with Buddhist ideas? And I would say not very well, because Buddhist ideas don't really think about consciousness in that way at all. From Buddhist ideas, consciousness is a unified thing. It is your experience of reality now. It is not a combination of small consciousnesses all coming together as material phenomena, giving rise to a large consciousness. Rather, it is a unified thing in individual people. So I don't know if panpsychism really works from a Buddhist point of view. I'm talking about these things fairly fast because, first of all, I don't know too much about them, so I would get into trouble if I tried to talk too much detail, but also because it doesn't really matter that much. And then there is another worldview, which is very interesting, which is very perhaps very close to Buddhist ideas. And this is called idealism. Yeah, and the idea of idealism is that what really is the world? The world really exists in the mind. Yeah, that is the idealist outlook. And the idea behind that is that what we really have as human beings, we have experience. And everything in the world exists within that experience. Experience is primary, and every law of universe or whatever that we deduce is all deduced from that experience. So the primary thing that we know is experience. Everything else is secondary. So the idea that everything really exists somehow in mind, yeah? And if you think about it, that's exactly how we experience the world. We experience everything as existing in mind. You sitting right here now in this beautiful Dhamma hall, which is unfortunately a little bit too empty, but otherwise it's very nice. So everything I experience here, well, I experience in the mind, the colors, the shapes, and everything. So it is a fairly kind of natural way of thinking about the world, that things may actually be mental ultimately. Everything is experienced as part of a mental universe. And that is an idea that is also being proposed by very serious philosophers in the present day. Everything comes from the mind. In some ways, I think it is this idea of idealism that in many ways perhaps comes the closest to the Buddhist outlook. Yeah, in Buddhism, in the later philosophy of Buddhism, you have the idea of the mind-only school that arose in part also in Mahayana Buddhism. And it's the idea that mind is all there is and everything else is derived or somehow comes from that experience of the world. But it's not just Mahayana Buddhism, it's not just later Buddhism. If you read the early suttas of the Buddha, you find similar ideas. One of the well-known suttas of the Buddha is called the Rohitasa Sutta. And if anyone wants to look it up, it's found in the Anguttara Nikaya, Numerical Discourses. The fours, I think it's about 45 or thereabouts. And in this Rohitasa Sutta, the Buddha says that the world is found in this fathom-long body with its consciousness and perception. Yeah, the world is found in this fathom-long body with its perception and consciousness. And then he goes on to say that the origin of the world is also found in the same place. The end of the world is found in the same place. The path leading to the end of the world is also found in that place. It's a very interesting thing. What does the Buddha mean by that? And it may very well mean that the universe, the world, the word in Pali for world is loka. It is used exactly the same way that we use the word world. Not exactly, but very similar way. The way that we use the word world in the English language. Yeah, it can mean the planet, it can mean the universe, it can mean depending on context. What does the Buddha mean? The obvious answer is that he means everything is found in our consciousness. Yeah, that is kind of the obvious answer here. So was the Buddha an idealist? Maybe he was. But of course, it is very hard to say. Sometimes you can draw too many conclusions from a single sutta or a single point of view. It is possible that the Buddha may have meant, for example, that the world that matters to us, the world that we really have to deal with, in other words, our suffering, our experience, and all of these kind of things, that is fine in our consciousness. Yeah. So forget about anything outside. It's kind of irrelevant. It's our personal world that matters. He may have meant that. But it's also possible that the Buddha actually was thought about the world in idealistic sense. Everything happens in the mind. So maybe the Buddha was an idealist. I don't know. But that seems to be fairly close to this particular theory in modern philosophy. Perhaps. But of course, this gets complicated because there are many kinds of idealism and all these kind of things. That is just a rough idea of what is possible. So what does all this mean? And because this is kind of fascinating, yeah, that we are seeing this shift in the world. Science is moving in a certain way. There's like what they call a paradigm shift, whereby the idea, the outlook on the world is really moving from one thing, moving on to something else. And I think it is very exciting and very interesting, because what it means is that new possibilities, new ways of looking at the world suddenly open up in a big way. The problem, as I mentioned before, with the worldview that everything is material, it makes the mind a byproduct, and it makes the mind very unimportant. The mind doesn't really matter anymore because it just comes from material phenomena. And the way to deal with the mind is to deal with the material phenomena. This is the problem of that particular outlook. But if we open up the possibility that mind, at the very least, is a central aspect of the phenomenal world, it is a core part of what the world is about, then suddenly it changes the equation dramatically. Suddenly, if you think, suddenly things like that we talk about in Buddhism, like rebirth and karma and all of these kind of things, suddenly that possibility is opened up. Not just that, but suddenly the idea of developing the mind, or practicing a spiritual life, or going back to those ancient cloisters and monasteries of Middle Age Europe and practicing meditation, if you want to look at it that way, suddenly all of that becomes very interesting again. Because if the mind is an independent thing that actually exists in some way and is not just derived from material phenomena, then working, doing something with that mind suddenly becomes very possible and very interesting, even though it didn't do so before. So this is what it opens up. It opens up a new avenue, a new way of looking at the world, which is really very, very interesting. And I think our society is gradually moving in that direction. Gradually, we're finding this new possibility for spiritual growth, for mental development. And of course, all of this fits in beautifully with the way we think about the world in a Buddhist ways. So because of that, I think that as Buddhists, we are well positioned to take advantage of the shift in paradigms, the new way of looking at the world. And I think if we catch this kind of wave of change and we use it wisely, I think we may have a big opportunity to have an input in that change and how things are looked at in both science and philosophy, and also because of that in broader society, because these things trickle down into broader society, of course. But it's not just, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's not just science and philosophy that are going through changes. I also mentioned another challenge to the materialist or physicalist paradigm, and that challenge comes from people's search for meaning. We want meaning in our lives, we want a sense of purpose, and the materialist paradigm, the problem with that, it tends to kind of destroy so much of the meaning in our world. It is interesting. You sometimes wonder, why is it that our world is so materialistic? Why is it people are so keen on big cars, on big houses, on big bank accounts? Why has the world kind of gone so far in that direction? Why is it that we are not capable of looking after the world properly? Why is it that climate change is happening so badly and nobody really seems to be able to deal with it properly? Why do we have this coronavirus is kind of infecting the world? Why do things seem to be so unbalanced in a way? And the answer, I think, a large part of the answer is precisely this physicalist outlook on the world. Why? Well, because it is true that everything comes from physical phenomena, if the mind is a mere byproduct of the physical world, then of course it is in the physical world that the solutions have to be found. If you want to find happiness, well, somehow it is going to come from the outside. Somehow it's going to come from the size of your car. Somehow it's going to come from the kind of entertainment you have or the relationship you have, so whatever it is, else it is. Somehow it must come from the outside. So we are creating a materialistic society where the things in the world matter so enormously precisely because our philosophical understanding of the world is so lopsided and one-sided. One type of materialism, in other words, the physicalism of philosophy, leads to a materialistic kind of attitude in people whereby we look for only the creature comforts and the physical things in the world around us. So we have created a very lopsided world, and I think this is part of the problem. This is why we live in a society. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why we live in such an unbalanced society, I think. And this is also why we are so incredibly concerned about economic growth. Yeah, one of the first things that you read about in the paper is when the coronavirus comes, is how it's going to affect economic growth. Yeah, it's going to be bad. It's going to be worse than the global, global financial crisis, GFC in 2008. Yeah, it's going to be really, really bad. And sometimes the worry about the economy is kind of greater than the worry about how many people are going to die. Yeah, because this is kind of the meaning of life lies in a growing economy. But what if that is mistaken? What if that is not the meaning of life? What if the meaning of life has to do with our minds, has to do with our inner growth instead? Well, then perhaps the economic growth is not so important anymore. Maybe even a bad coronavirus, which reduces the growth enormously, maybe we can just shrug it off and say, well, actually, there are other things in life that are more important. Of course, it's always going to matter a little bit, but it may not matter anywhere near as much as we think. So by having a materialistic outlook, a physicalist outlook of the world, we are destroying so much meaning here. We are kind of moving on, becoming beings who are obsessed with economic growth, obsessed with material things on the outside, and forgetting that actually there is something else far, far more important within human beings. And that is where the search for meaning comes. The search for meaning is instead to look inside, to find the place where really you can actually experience some real growth, growth that actually matters, growth that changes you in a personal way, directly at the source or where the problem lies. Because the source of suffering is obviously a mental problem. The source of not feeling fulfilled, the source of not feeling content in life, the source of feeling that this craving that is always driving you on, this itch inside that is never fulfilled, that is a mental problem. It is not something that ultimately can ever be fulfilled by external things. And once you get that, you start to realize the importance of moving away from the physicalist paradigm to move on to something that has more to do where the mind comes back into focus as one of the very fundamental aspects of our world and our existence, because that is where real fulfillment and happiness actually can be found. So in this way, I think that society, both in our search for meaning, but also in what is actually happening in the world in terms of philosophy and science, we are moving back again, hopefully. And of course, you never know whether you're right about these things, but that is my sense, just reading a little bit about what is happening in the world around me. That's what it looks to me, that we're moving and heading in that direction. And what a blessing that is. What a wonderful thing it is if our society is going in that way. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up tonight is because very often we despair about our world. We think the world is going down the drain. And there are many good reasons for thinking why that is the case. But sometimes we don't see all the currents going on underneath the surface. And there are probably lots and lots of different currents going on. And we only have a little bit of insight into what is happening here. But one of the currents I have been seeing is this current towards taking the mind as more important. And what a wonderful thing, what a wonderful possibility that is for the future of our society. Even if there is climate catastrophe, even if there is a big problem for coronavirus, even if there are all kind of problems from wars or whatever, still there are hopeful things also happening in our society at the same time. So please keep this in mind. And when we do this, what actually happens? Well, what happens is that we come back to this great distinction that I always like to make between whether we focus on results or whether we focus on the process by which we reach those results. That is one of those very important distinctions to make, because if we take the world to be materialistic and physicalist, then always we would tend to focus on the results in life, what we have, how much we get, whether we get the promotion or not. But the spiritual way of thinking about the world, the mental development way of thinking about the world, is to look at the process, understanding that the results are always out of control. You never know what success you're going to have in fighting the coronavirus. You never know what success we're going to have in dealing with climate change. But what we do know is that if we develop the mind in the right way, then it is going to work out in a good way for us. And that is what we need to do. To summarize all of this, I want to finish off with one story here. This story is a story that many of you probably know already. And it's a story that I have heard myself for ever since I came to Bodhinyana Monastery here. Yeah. And this story is, even though I heard it so many times, it took a long time before I really understand how profound it actually is and what it means for the spiritual path. And only recently did it start to dawn on me that actually there's something very deep and beautiful going on here. And this is really a story about Ajahn Brahm. It's a story about Ajahn Brahm and the fire that we had coming through Bodhinyana Monastery back in 1991. This fire happened on a day that was the hottest day, apparently in Perth, ever at that particular time. It was over 46 degrees, yeah? So if you want a kind of a preview of the hell realms, then that is probably not as close as you can get, at least in Perth, 46-something degrees. And not only was it 46 degrees, it was happened towards the end or just past the middle of summer, towards the end of January, yeah? It had been dry already for many, many weeks. That time in Western Australia, it is very, very rare to get rain. So it probably had been dry for anywhere between 4 and 8 weeks prior to that. And not only that, but it was also a very windy day on top of all of those things. So you can imagine, highest temperature ever towards the end of the dry season, on top of that very high wind. And then a fire gets lit. And the fire comes from the south, the fire is in the south, the wind also comes from the south, it is heading towards Bodhinyana Monastery, yeah? And of course, what happens is that the fire brigade comes to the monastery, and they all assemble in the hall, they're talking about what to do, yeah? And eventually, they realize they're gonna have to evacuate. And as they are evacuating, Ajahn Brahm tells me how they could see the fire coming. And it was one of those extremely scary experiences because literally the trees would explode as the fire would move from one tree to the next one. Because the wind was so strong, the fire would be thrown from one tree. Even if the trees were far apart, it would kind of be moved from one tree to the next one because the heat was so high and because the oil content of the eucalyptus tree, the local gum trees, is so high, they would literally explode. Yeah, bang, go off like a bomb. And later on, when you saw the pictures of Bodhinyana Monastery, it looked like a moon landscape. I've seen the pictures myself. Everything is grey here. There's nothing, there's not a single leaf left on the trees. The ground is completely full of ash and dirt, and that's all that there is in the entire monastery here. It looks like you're on Mars or on the moon or something like that. It looks completely desolate. It looks like nobody could possibly live in that sort of place. Of course, in reality, the trees come back again. Yeah, it doesn't take long. The leaves start to sprout again, and the greenery comes back. So it wasn't devastating for the monastery here, but it was looking very, very bad at the time. So at that point, they're about to evacuate the monastery because the fire brigade is also starting to panic a little bit. This is a really bad fire. You have these buildings that have a lot of wood in them. Yeah, it's going to burn down. Yeah, at that point, when they were leaving the monastery, Ajahn Brahm told me this specifically. At that point, I knew the monastery was going to burn down there. And this, it's important to understand the context of this, because it's a very powerful context here. Ajahn Brahm was the main builder of Bodhinyana Monastery. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm literally had his name signed on the building permission for some of the buildings at Bodhinyana Monastery. He had spent working up to 10, 12 hours per day, every day for the previous 7 years. Yeah, they came to Bodhinyana Monastery in November 1983. This was January 1991, so about 7 years, yeah, almost exactly, a little bit over 7 years. And he had spent pretty much all his time, day in, day out, for 7 years, building up Bodhinyana Monastery. And it had become a very beautiful monastery. Yeah, the main hall there is very nice. They had a nice dana sala. They had kutis in the forest and a ablution block. They even had some nice gardens that had been made for the monastery specifically. It had become a very beautiful place and a very peaceful place, very suitable for spiritual practice. This was Ajahn Brahm's life's work, this monastery. He had built everything up. Hour in, day in, day out, hour after hour, building up this place. And now he was sure that the fire would come and would burn everything down. Imagine that for a second, what that is like when you have spent your and almost most of your life, or the biggest part of your life, building something up, putting all your effort into something, and then something comes and destroys it completely. Imagine it is your home, for example, the home that you have lived in for your entire life, where you have all your belongings, and a fire comes and burns it down. What does it feel like? Or you have been writing or doing something, spent many, many years building it up, your life's work, and then it is destroyed for some particular reason. What does it feel like? And what it feels like for the vast majority of people is there a sense of despair. I spent my whole life doing this. I was moving towards this thing, and now it is all gone. This is how it happens for most people. So I asked Ajahn Brahm, or Ajahn Brahm told me, well, at that moment, he says, I knew the monastery was going to burn down. It was going to be no more. But at the moment, I knew the monastery was going to burn down. At the same moment, I knew that tomorrow morning, when the fire is gone and the ashes are left, I will come back and I will start from scratch, building it up again. Imagine that. Imagine letting go so fast and so thoroughly that you let go of everything you have done in the previous 7 years, just like that, and then having the idea that you can come back and start from scratch again the following day. It is almost superhuman. I don't know about any of you listening to this, but we often talk about psychic powers and superhuman powers in Buddhism, and there can be all kind of cool things like, you know, going into walking on water and kind of sinking into the ground and flying in the air, and that's all very well. But to me, this kind of power, the ability to let go like that, that to me is the real superhuman powers, because it is really outside the range of the majority of people in this world. You just can't let go of something which you have spent your whole life building up. So I then asked Ajahn Brahm, I asked him, how? Because it took me a long time to really get the significance of this. I didn't really understand it for years, the significance of what actually happened. So eventually, when I started to understand, I asked him, how did you do this? How is it possible to let go so completely? And that was the interesting part, because then he told me that it was because I wasn't interested in the result. I wasn't doing this for the outcome. I wasn't doing this because I wanted a beautiful monastery. I did it because it was a good thing to do. I did it as an act of generosity. I did it as an act of compassion and kindness for the world. So as soon as it burned down, well, that kindness could continue on the next day by just building up anything. I hadn't lost anything by the burning down, because everything I had done it for a very different purpose. Build up good spiritual qualities inside. Those qualities were still there, and the next day I would have a chance to continue building up those same good spiritual qualities. So that is the idea behind the idea of not focusing on results, but focusing on the process instead. We remember that what really matters in the long run, because the world is out of control, is actually how we live our life, how we deal with things, and not the outcomes, because the outcomes are always going to be out of control, as they were for Ajahn Brahm. Fortunately, of course, the monastery didn't actually burn down. It was still there on the following day, which was good, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be here now. So I guess that's kind of handy, at least for me. So, and that is really what this is about. But also, I just want to say that it is very difficult for the majority of people to get to that point where you can let go so completely. And in the meantime, it is also nice sometimes to hear some positive views of the world. And that's why I also wanted to share with you maybe a different angle on understanding where we go going in the world. Okay, so I have talked plenty long enough, so I'm going to stop there. And if we want, we can take some questions from overseas. There's no questions from the hall today because there is almost nobody here. But we can take some questions from overseas anyway. So let's do that. Okay, thank you. Okay, so these are questions. The first one is from Jacinta in Belgium. And the question is as follows. I am working in care. I am taking a risk that my aging father will live with me. How can I deal with the guilt of possibly being the cause of infecting a person I love? Okay, so I suppose that What you have to do, I suppose, is to discuss the situation with your father and to make it very clear that, you know, the risk that you are taking, and to make sure that he supports you in that. You probably have done that already, I can imagine. And then if he does support you and you are both on the same page, then it is a wonderful opportunity, in a sense, for both of you to make good merit. The world needs people like you right now. You work in care, because right now this epidemic happening around the world is a wonderful thing to be able to practice the Buddhist path of compassion and caring for others at this particular time. And this is the great thing about the disasters in the world, is that there actually are opportunities for compassion and kindness. So if your father is supporting you, then he is also making good karma, because he is also understanding the importance of somebody doing the right thing. So in a sense, you are giving your father as well an opportunity to do good karma by what you're doing. So you ask him whether he is on board. If he is on board, then what a wonderful thing it is for both of you. At the same time, you do your very best to keep your distance. You do your very best to isolate. Maybe you can even isolate your father in a room when you are around or something. I'm not really sure what possibilities you have. At the same time, you do your very, very best to avoid any infection between you and your father at the same time. That is what I would recommend. But remember, death is not always a disaster. Death is not bad. If we can live our life well, and we have done the right thing in our lives, then dying is often a very positive experience. We can die joyfully, knowing that we have lived well. So it is not necessarily remotely as bad as you may think it is. Do your very best, and then maybe you can even make some good karma in the process. Sometimes life is difficult. You have difficult choices. And sometimes there is no ideal choice. And sometimes you just have to make the best of a difficult situation. Next one. This is from Pam in Scotland. And she says the Jesuits had a big influence in trade in Asia in the 16th and 17th centuries. Do you think the Catholic practices filtered into Buddhism? Did Catholic practices filter into Buddhism? I would be very surprised if there wasn't some infiltration. The world is so interrelated and interdependent in so many different ways that we're all influenced by each other. It is just inconceivable that it shouldn't be some kind of influence. We know that Buddhism was heavily influenced by Hinduism, for example. And if you look at the Tibetan Buddhism, you will see a lot of Hindu influences in Tibetan Buddhism. We know that Buddhism was influenced by Tibetan indigenous religion, the Bon religion. We know that Buddhism had an influence on Christianity. Some of the Christian stories are actually ancient Buddhist stories. So everything is influenced by everything else. For that reason, this is actually one of the reasons why I always like to try to go back as far as possible and to the word of the Buddha itself, if possible, because that is probably the most uncontaminated expression of Buddhism. And the more uncontaminated it is, the more likely you are to get the right thing. I'm not suggesting that all other Buddhism is bad or you shouldn't do it or whatever. All of the other Buddhism can be very inspiring. I saw somebody writing something today that the Jataka tales actually can be very interesting. The Jataka tales are the stories of the Buddha's past lives. Sometimes those stories can be beautiful, and they can be kind of enlivening, and they can actually make you feel better because they are more human than the suttas. The suttas can often be a bit dry, but some of these stories can have more of a humane kind of element to them. So we can do all of these things, but in the end, if you want to really find out what Buddhism is, you come back to the early suttas, the long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, and the numerical discourse. That is the real teaching of the Buddha. If you want to understand Buddhism deeply, it's really the only way you can do that. That's where you have a deep expressions of what morality is in Buddhism, a deep and profound and detailed understanding of meditation practice, and especially a deep understanding of wisdom. And you don't really find that anywhere else in these other stories and things. So, but yes, basically, I think you're right, but I don't actually know exactly what those ideas might be. But no doubt, there was some kind of influence there. Okay, the last one is from DY in the USA. How do I find the right balance between letting go, detachment, resulting in selfishness or self-neglect, and the correct amount of attachment to the present to live well? Well, if you detach in the right way, you don't really become selfish, or you don't really neglect yourself. Because detachment has more to do with with how you relate to things mentally than actually to what you do. So if you are more detached, then you still look after yourself, because you know it is important to look after your body. In fact, when you are more detached, you tend to become even more kind, less selfish. Because attachment to other people very often means that there's a vested interest in that relationship between us and them. If you are attached to your children, for example, you want your children to get straight A's at school. You want them to be really good at sport. You want them to play an instrument to perfection and all of these kind of things. And if they don't behave properly in front of other people, you feel embarrassed. Why? Because they are your children. You are attached to those children. That is the problem with attachment. We are concerned not only with our children's well-being, but we're also concerned with how we feel in the presence of our children. So it is not the best way of being able to love somebody when you have an attachment. If you really want to love somebody, if you really want to have proper sense of compassion, detachment is far more powerful, because then you can actually observe and you can actually look what truly is beneficial for the other person. So it's very important to understand detachment in the right way. What it means is that more like you have you stand back from existence. You look more at things from a bird's eye point of view. You don't have all of these hooks, this kind of emotional hooks into other people, whereby you can manipulate people. Rather, you are become unmanipulatable because of that lack of attachment. And then you can really observe what is required in the world to do well. If you look at the arahants of the world, or the people who have practiced the path a very long way, they are not selfish. They don't have self-neglect at all. Rather, they are the most generous, the most kind-hearted people around, and yet they have no attachments. So make that your ideal, and then you'll be on the right track. Okay. That is all for tonight. So goodbye, everyone, the few of you who are here, and also all those online. So let's just pay respect to Bodhidharma Sangha to finish off.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangha.